Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area. My co-host for today is Marty Miller. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Susan. Glad to be here.
Our listeners may know you mostly through the music programs you've hosted, but you're bringing us something very different today, some very different guests. Could you introduce them?
I sure can. This is my wife, Marcia Miller, my very good friends, David and Hannah Gradwall, who will be speaking later on the program about their recent trip to Germany, where they traveled what might be called a memorial pilgrimage. But before that, we'll be continuing the theme of Monday's Loco Talk show, where we were more traditional American Memorial Day.
Yes, we agreed that for our memories of Memorial Day, there was something missing in the Veterans Day program on Monday. So our guest, your wife, Marcia, will be reporting about Memorial Day in Maxwell. So, welcome, Marcia, Hannah, and David, and thanks to all of you for being with us in the studio.
In addition to memorials, the program will talk about immigration, something that we often feature, especially as we're coming up on Scandinavian Days in Story City in a couple of weeks.
And last week, our intern, Jasmine Merguria, who is of Mexican ancestry, brought us a report of the Mexican community in Nevada with some Spanish-English translations.
This is the time we should turn the program over to my wife, Marcia.
Welcome back, Marcia. Our listeners may remember you from the program on Century Farms when you brought the deed to your family farm in 1846. Where did your family come from, and what was the family name?
Well, my ancestry is almost completely in the U.K., Scots, English, and Irish. My maiden name was Stevenson. They were from the borderlands of Scotland. And my mother's family was Kennedy, and that's a very Scottish name. Most of these people had migrated to the U.S. by the mid-1700s and were in Iowa by the mid-1800s. Of course, Iowa became a state in 1846.
But is that the reason that you went to Maxwell? You have family graves there?
Well, yes, that's one of the reasons we went. We probably wouldn't go to Maxwell otherwise. But the other name, if you recall, for Memorial Day is Decoration Day. And
yes.
That's kind of the non-veteran part.
Yes. Well, that was the part that that seemed missing to me because my memory of Memorial Day was taking peonies, Memorial Day peonies, to my grandmother's grave.
Exactly. When I was a child, we did that. Every year we'd pick up my grandmother's and we'd all go out to the cemeteries, and sometimes we'd even have a picnic.
Yes, but I suppose the reason that's changed is that so few people have graves nearby.
Right.
You happen to. That's a very, very unusual circumstance. My grandmother's grave is in Kansas. I never went back there.
Right. Well, my family graves are in Ottumwa. We could go there, but it's too far. Unfortunately, we do have a grave nearby. We lost our son 4 years ago. He lived in Maxwell. His in-laws had given them land on their farm to build a home. So he actually lived right across the road from the Maxwell Cemetery. And he took care of it. He mowed it. So when he became ill and it became obvious that he probably was going to die, he wanted to be buried there. And we go out there because of that. And he also was a Story County Deputy Sheriff, so people out there know him. And it's very pleasant for us to be with all the – a lot of people come. It's quite a busy time. And aside from all of the usual veterans things, which they also have, they have music. We had a guitar player and a singer. And they have food. We have coffee and donuts. And then we just all sort of gather. And a lot of people talk about Mike because they knew him as a deputy. And I think it's kind of like a misery loves company gathering of relatives and friends.
Well, it's like a memorial service often is like a family reunion. You see people you haven't seen for a long time. You have memories of the person that make you cry but also feel a little warm.
Yeah.
Often a little humor.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Right. And it's a beautiful little country cemetery. When we took our rabbi out there, he said it's like a Grant Wood painting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. that is certainly part of the traditional ceremony. Mm-hmm. But the origins of Memorial Day are really, according to the source of all knowledge today, Wikipedia, start with the Civil War, or perhaps even a little before, when people did exactly what you're talking about. If they had family cemeteries nearby, they'd come out and they'd have a picnic on the ground, and they'd decorate the graves. And so if they started doing that in the South, even during the Civil War, and then afterwards, it was both in the North and the South. So a little mm-hmm. Civil War memorabilia also might be appropriate, and we just happen to have a man with us who has ancestors who fought on both sides in the Civil War. So, David, would you give us a little family history, how your ancestors happened to be settled in both the North and the South?
My direct ancestors were immigrants to the United States between the 1840s and the early 1860s. They were Western Ashkenazi Jews from Alsace and various German states and Austria. Two of my great-grandfathers were in the American Civil War, one on the side of the North and one on the side of the South. My Union great-grandfather, David Mayer, after whom I was named, was born in 1819 in Staudenheim, a small village in the Rhineland Falls area of Germany. He immigrated to the United States in 1848. And during the Civil War, he was a private in Company I of the 11th New York State Militia. After his service, he returned to New York City, where he owned a shoe and boot store. He died some 40 years later and is buried in the Mount Lebanon section of Wyuka Cemetery in Lincoln, Nebraska, where I grew up. As a child, I visited his grave with my mother and grandparents on Memorial Day. And my recollection is we may have called it Decoration Day.
Yes.
And actually, my mother and grandparents liked to go out there the day before so it was more private and there wouldn't be so many people out there. And I enjoyed those visits because the adults would tell stories about the relatives who were buried there. Today we'd call that oral history. My Confederate great-grandfather, Jonas Moses Rosenbaum, was born in Pretzfeld, Bavaria. He immigrated to the United States with his parents in the 1850s. During the war between the states, which is what they call it in the South, he was a private in Company C of the 10th Battalion of the Georgia Infantry. He survived the war and settled in Raleigh, North Carolina, where he operated a department store. 20 years later, he was run over and killed by a horse-drawn fire engine. He is buried in the Magnolia Hill section of Oakwood Cemetery in Raleigh, North Carolina. In addition, two of my great-great-uncles, Adolph and Albert Wise, born in Chodau, a village near Karlsbad, Austria, which is now Karlovy Vary in the Czech Republic, they served in the Confederate Army during the Civil War, and they are buried in the Beth El Cemetery in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Well, now you have really taken us back, and thank you. And you're opening a whole new window for KHOI. I'll bet there's a lot of genealogy out there that we might track down. But that's very, very interesting. And I think you told me something else about one of those cemeteries, that perhaps it was the last one, that he was not buried. Oh, well, he wasn't with the war dead, though.
No, interestingly enough, the families of those people chose to bury them in the Jewish sections of those cemeteries, not in the military section, although in two of the cases, you could throw a gravestone from the Jewish section to the military section. They're that close.
Yeah.
But I think that that there was a strong desire to be buried in, as we call it, sacred or consecrated ground.
Well, this brings up a lot of deep, deep things that we're probably going to be dealing with a little bit more later in the program. You have been listening to KHOI Community Radio, where we've been talking with Marcia Miller and David Gradwall about the traditions of celebrating Memorial Day here in Iowa, and with a little link to other Memorial Day or Decoration Day celebrations throughout the country connected with Civil War veterans and those who died.
Yeah, and now we'll be talking with Hannah and David Gradwall together about the trip that they just returned from to commemorate the deaths of members of their family during World War II. What I'd like to do now is let's listen to one of the wonderful klezmer bands called Beyond the Pale.
Marty, that's music that I think a lot of people haven't heard. It's folk music, but it's got a minor key, and you've brought that to us. Where does that come from?
Well, that's klezmer music. It's been called Yiddish music. It's been called Jewish music. It originated in Eastern Europe, and it's a traditional music of that area. I think it was composed in the 1800s. And it was very popular until mid-1900s. It came over the United States and it fused with jazz. And so the klezmer music that we hear nowadays is a combination of Eastern Europe and American jazz. And that particular piece was done by a band called Beyond the Pale. And it's a band that is from Canada and is one of the really great klezmer bands in the world. Diaphamous Charms is the name of the tune that we just heard, and it's from a CD called Consensus, which is was produced by the Borealis Record Company here. It's one of my favorite, and it's a beautiful piece. Here.
Well, actually, when I asked you that question, partly a rhetorical question, because I discovered klezmer, well, in the 70s, at the maintenance shop. The reason I went, I'd never heard of klezmer music, but it was a well-known klezmer band, but I wasn't well-known in Ames, and so they had lots and lots of tickets, and so they gave them away. So we went, and the place was packed, and the klezmer musicians sort of bounced in after we were all sitting, and it was so dynamic. And then the story of how they started playing, they got this music off cylinders, the old wax cylinders from,
right.
I don't know, what are the dates on those wax cylinders, the 20s, 30s?
Yeah, in the 20s, yes.
Mm-hmm. And this was music that wasn't being played anymore anywhere, I guess. And they listened to it and reconstructed it. And they said that it had been played in movie theaters and, you know, that it was very, very popular. It was street music when it came over to America. You know, people were playing it on the streets of of Odessa, a city that's been recently in the news, I believe.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they started reviving it. And I guess from there it's revived a lot.
It sure is, yes. Yeah, and you hear this music and most all bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, Jewish weddings, and it's very danceable.
So this is the lead into Hannah's story.
Sure. And Hannah, you know, you were born in Germany. So would you tell us about your immigration to the United States?
Well, it is correct. I am an immigrant. I was born in Coburg, Germany. My father, along with my grandfather and great uncle, owned a department store in Sonneberg, which is in southwestern Germany. In 1936, my maternal grandparents were able to escape from Hitler's Germany, going to Lincoln, Nebraska. They were sponsored by cousins who provided the papers, affidavits, and employment for them when they got to Lincoln. Also in 1936, my aunt, uncle, and cousin were able to flee from Germany to Palestine, which is present-day Israel. And in 1937, my parents and I were able to escape the Nazi regime and move in with my grandparents in Lincoln. I don't remember anything of that as I was not yet 2 years old. Unfortunately, my paternal grandparents were unable to escape from Germany, though they sought refuge in Cuba, the U.S., South America, Palestine, and other European countries. They had what was called too high a number and never qualified for being able to leave the country of Germany. They had moved from their home in Sonneberg to Frankfurt, thinking that they would have more security in a larger Jewish community. Of course, in my way of thinking, gathering all the Jews together made it much easier for the Nazis to attack and overcome them. In September 1942, they were deported to Theresienstadt, which is located in the present-day Czech Republic, and ultimately they were sent to Treblinka, where they were murdered.
Yeah, that's quite a story, isn't it, Susan?
So what is the memorial?
Yeah, they just returned from Germany.
Yes, yes.
Was a special trip and a very emotional event.
Yes.
That is true. We had heard that there was a plan to have a memorial for my grandparents near the home where they last lived before their deportation. And David and I were able to arrange to be there and participate in a memorial ceremony commemorating the deaths of my paternal grandparents, Bernhard and Hedwig Rosenberg, and my great uncle, Julius Speyer, in Frankfurt, Germany. The ceremony actually took place on the sidewalk in front of the last house where my grandparents and my uncle lived before their deportation. Memorial blocks, or Stolpersteine, which is the German word for that, were placed in the walkway by Günter Demnig, the artist who developed these memorials 25 years ago. 50,000 of these memorials have been placed around Europe in the intervening years. Stolperstein literally means a stumbling block and is intended to help people remember the individuals who died in the Holocaust. There was a fairly large group of people observing this ceremony, and a large banner was unfurled in the background, and the banner stated in German and translated, "Stones Against Forgetting." People should be reminded of all the lives which were lost. These people were not just numbers, but names. Each cement block is capped with a brass plate, which is engraved with the name, date of birth, and in my grandparents' and my great uncle's case, deported to Theresienstadt, murdered at Treblinka.
That's quite a story.
This was a very moving ceremony, and it was probably as moving for me as it was for Hannah. Since we met as young children, I was not yet 4 and she was not yet 2, so I know her family well. But it was quite an emotional thing. Hannah's young cousin, who lives in Berlin, had arranged for us to stay at a hotel in the neighborhood where her grandparents and great uncle had lived, and they had to keep moving because the Nazis were taking over apartments. But we visited and were able to photograph the houses they lived in, the neighborhood streets that they walked. We ate brunch in their favorite restaurant. It was their favorite restaurant until the laws prohibited Jews from eating in public places. So the whole context and the ceremony was extremely moving, and quite a collection of people were there. Neighbors who'd lived nearby and people just out jogging stopped and asked questions. And I thought that was very good because, after all, the purpose of the Stolpersteine is education and remembrance.
And one of the things that you told me, it didn't exactly surprise me because I knew that there were many other groups besides Jews that were targeted. You told me that the first ones that they did were for the Gypsies who were
for the Roma. Sinti.
Sinti.
Demnig started that in Cologne. Mm-hmm. And most of the Stolpersteine commemorate Jews, but they're also, and in fact, the weekend we were there, one stone was being set for a Jehovah's Witness. There are stones set for communists, for homosexuals. For
people with handicaps, people that were not deemed perfect persons.
Yes, rather cynically, and this is noted on the Stolpersteine, it's sort of code talk on the stones, but it's basically for people who were somewhat handicapped, though still viable, and the Nazis gave them euthanasia, mercy killings. But they, of course, were experimenting with ways to kill people.
In our visit to Germany, both in Berlin and in Frankfurt, as we walked around the cities, we noted Stolpersteine that had been put in already in the neighborhoods where we visited. And you don't notice them. They're flush with the sidewalk. But if you're looking for them, they pop up. And we photographed many in our trip there.
We hadn't seen one before. And we discovered there was one right next door to the hotel we are staying in Berlin. And we've stayed in that hotel two other times when we've been in Berlin. And just walking around the neighborhood, we photographed more than two dozen just in that one area of the Schöneberg district of Berlin.
Well, you mentioned that there was a banquet in the evening for all of those 150 that had been put out in Frankfurt. And that must have been very interesting because then you met the other people who had.
Yes, the people came from, that we know of, from Israel, the United States, and Germany. And this was held at a little village just outside of Frankfurt, up on a mountain, a low mountain, where you could see out over Frankfurt. And it was held at a place called the Budga Stiftung, the Budga Foundation. And this couple named Budga, 100 years ago, had established an endowment for the construction of a retirement home where specifically Jews and Christians could live together and retire and be in harmony. And this facility today is beautiful. They have beautiful retirement apartments. They have a Christian chapel and a little Jewish chapel. And it's sort of a paradigm for how people really ought to be living. And there it is, a strong survivor of Nazi fanaticism.
Well, there's many, many interesting stories that come out of that. And maybe we can talk about some of them after we give our station ID. This is KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM. And today our guests are Hannah and Dave Gradwall and Marcia Miller. And my co-host is Marty Miller, and I'm Susan Franzen. And we hope you will stay with us to explore this. Could we have a little more klezmer music? Just a little. Well, that was a little different than the first klezmer music we heard. And having heard the whole CD, I can say that everyone is amazingly different than every other one. But now we're going to go to something that is more familiar in some ways to our listeners. We often pick a state organization like the Country Schools, the Organization for the Preservation of Country Schools, and we have one on Century Farms, which of course was where Marcia came in with her deed. But there is also an organization, and I believe, David, you're more familiar with this than I am, the Organization for...
This is the SAPIC, the State Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries. And it's composed of people all over the state that are dedicated to preserving pioneer cemeteries. Many of these are just small cemeteries out in the middle of plowed fields. They have made sure that there's legislation allowing people to go into those cemeteries and making it an offense to plow over them and destroy them. Unfortunately, some farmers don't want to have to turn their big plows, so they just remove the gravestones and plow over them. And fortunately, that's not too common, but it does occur. So SAPIC is dedicated to doing this and also to going into these pioneer cemeteries and restoring and repairing the broken gravestones. We have in other states too, but a really interesting heritage. And cemeteries, I think, are important cultural resources. They're material remains of the past. As an archaeologist, I'm interested in material remains and what they mean throughout time. We're very fortunate here in Story County. We have a thesis, master's thesis, and publication by Colleen Nutty entitled Cemetery Symbolism of Prairie Pioneers. And she did a study of Story County cemeteries and recorded all of the graves in selected cemeteries and did an anthropological and historical analysis of the symbolism, the change in gravestone types, and that sort of thing, which fits in with the archaeological study of contemporary cemeteries.
Now, I think that perhaps we should introduce you a little beyond your original introduction. You are a retired professor of anthropology and archaeology, is that correct here?
Yes, archaeology is a subfield of anthropology. But yeah. I taught anthropology, several of the subfields, and also American Indian Studies.
And that's, of course, another issue with disturbing graves.
Absolutely.
And could you talk about that a little? I think we had one here in Ames that caused a little dislocation in a development. Is that?
Yes. I feel very fortunate to have had my career here in Iowa, because given a little boost by Maria Pearson, and we've had a program on Maria on KHOI previously, but Iowa archaeologists got together and worked with Native Americans in changing the Iowa burial code so that it was now an offense to intentionally dig up an American Indian grave. Ones which have been unintentionally discovered by construction activities. The remains are removed, studied by the Office of the State Archaeologist personnel, and then reburied. And we did have a problem north of town where a burial mound was identified in a lot in Northridge. And after a lot of discussion and a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, that burial mound site could not be built upon but had to be preserved, which I think is the ethical thing to do. We should be just as sensitive about the graves of American Indians and African Americans and so forth as those of us who are of Euro-American descent.
Mm-hmm. So you've really had a career in preserving graves.
Well, I have. I wrote an article called My Life in the Cemetery because I've spent quite a bit of time in cemeteries from several different dimensions. And my interest, as I indicated earlier in this program, goes back to childhood experiences where I really enjoyed these trips to the cemetery, which most of my age mates thought, oh, you know, cemeteries are spooky places. Well, I thought they were kind of beautiful parks, and I loved the stories that went along with it. And I realized I couldn't have verbalized it at the time, but essentially these gravestones represent lives, and particularly in family plots, you have like a kinship chart laid out in stone. And one of the stories that I enjoyed, one of my grandfather's brothers was married three times. His wives, I think, kept dying in childbirth. And so there is Uncle Simon laid out with three wives. And I kept asking my mother, was he married to them all at the same time? And she explained, no, that they had died and that he had married. But two of the women he married were half-sisters of my grandmother. And so when I got to be a teenager, I asked my grandmother, I said, did Uncle Simon have to marry two half-sisters to have one complete wife? And I'm not sure my grandmother was amused.
Probably not. Actually, you've also raised something that's an issue for all of us, even those who haven't studied cemeteries. And that's the relation that you have to them, how you feel about both them and the people in them. I was once doing some local history on my town in Kansas, and I'd done a lot, you know, of all of the early people and the leading visitors and I that knew from my own childhood the family story about Aunt Doll marrying Uncle Hugo, who was 20 years younger than she was, and he died well before she did, and there were family chucklings about old woman was too much for him. And I thought, well, is that really true? Well, I found their gravestones, and I felt, oh, this is like going to a party where you know half of the people. And it was, and I realized that's now being lost because you don't have whole communities buried together. Although cemetery walks here in Iowa, we've had featured two here on KHOI, one down in Slater and one in Ames. So people are going back to get acquainted a little bit more with their past.
I have had an interesting experience with Marty because he never did this. He never visited a cemetery. And part of it,
I try to keep out of them.
Part of it, I think, is because growing up in Chicago, the cemeteries are so huge. And, you know, some people were not there. But anyway, he never visited a cemetery. So in doing genealogy and in my history of visiting cemeteries, I've taken him to a lot. And he jokes that, you know, every time we go through a town, we better stop there and see if there's a Goldsberry. Goldsberry is one of the names in my mother's side of the family. And interestingly, I think my family was so pervasive in Iowa, the little cemetery where Mike is buried in Maxwell has a Goldsberry grave. And I looked up in my genealogy and they're related. So yeah. I had no idea, you know, that there was a Goldsberry in that cemetery. So there was, we always look for
that
them.
That person was buried quite some time ago.
Oh, yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah.
They farmed in the same area that Mike's in-laws farmed.
Yeah.
You never know what you're going to find.
Yeah. I grew up almost with an antipathy to genealogy because I thought it was, you know, kind of a snooty thing to do to prove that you had an important relative, important ancestor. And so I was surprised when my daughter became very interested in it. Like many parents, I got led along by her interest and have discovered quite fascinating connections. And I think that's where, I guess now with DNA research, you can find out. But that came before your work, didn't it, David? Or after, I mean.
In the middle of. I just have had some DNA tests and am corresponding with a man in California who is probably a third or fourth cousin. We're related. Our DNA is related rather closely. And we had corresponded before. His name is also Gradville. Our ancestors come from Alsace, which was Germany but is now France. And most of the Gradwells I've met, many of them come from Alsace, and we're finding out now with DNA just how we may be related.
There are other things besides that that technology makes possible, and one of them, of course, is because of the Internet. You can do research very easily. I read a couple of articles over the weekend about millions of graves. You can find gravestones online. And, of course, when you make contact with someone, of course, the rule on genealogy is that the living people don't get into your you can't find out about them online. They're not in your official genealogy. So sometimes that's a block toward finding a distant cousin. I don't know how you found the Gradfall in California. But.
Well, some people I've met through the Jewish Genealogical Family Finder, that, and I'm sure there are similar programs for other national and ethnic groups, religious groups, and so forth. But I have, quote, met people. I met a fifth cousin once removed who lives in Berlin, and we have become extremely close. In fact, we visited him three times since we met online, and he's visited us here in Iowa. And we met through that Jewish genealogical family finder. And we're able to share information because he did not have information on a lot of the lines that immigrated to the United States. But he, who is a historian and a totally bilingual in German and English, could analyze these documents that he found in Germany. So it's interesting. I've become closer and shared all kinds of personal information with people who are, you know, third, fourth, and fifth cousins, maybe more than people closer, genealogically speaking, that I've met, but we're not particularly close.
Oh, and I think that's also, in this area, very, very true for the Scandinavians. Back when, was it Travel Genie was in here in Ames?
Yes.
They used to have a genealogical section, and they had topo maps, which are very detailed maps of, I don't know, maybe a square mile or so, maybe a little more. And they had villages in – they had them for Norway. And they had villages in Norway where you could see every house. Of course, I suppose now that we have Google Earth, why we could fly over those and see them in more recent time with every house. But it's still so overwhelming that you can physically go back. You can get in touch with people that you've never heard of. And you can get maps in the local map store. And in fact, the new director of the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway, the museum, the James H. Andrew Museum, before coming here, he was curator of a museum in Illinois that he said was the Ellis Island of I'm not sure whether it was Scandinavian immigration or Swedish immigration. But in any case, hundreds of people, I mean, more than hundreds, tens of thousands of people came through there every year seeking ancestral connections. Mm-hmm. So it's everywhere around us, and I think
you still can get in touch with people that are living.
Yes.
Facebook, you know, different ways. And I have met a fifth cousin once removed also who was doing genealogy work on the Goldsberries, and I was doing genealogy work on the Goldsberries, and we came across each other's name. Excuse me. He lives in Cincinnati, and we have become fast friends with these folks, and we just really have enjoyed them, and we never would have met them, not, you know, if we weren't doing genealogy.
I think, though, that one of the reasons that they don't release the names of living relatives is because of the possibility of fraud and exploitation.
Yeah.
But apparently, you can get some fun relatives.
Yes,
for that.
Right, right. You can establish like a website of a name, mm-hmm. and then everybody just flocks to that name, and then you can get in touch with each other.
Well, it's so much easier if you have a name like Goldsberry instead
right.
of Smith.
That's right. Yes,
Hannah. Yes.
When we visited Germany several years ago, we went to the home town of my mother and aunt, Halberstadt, Germany, and they had maintained contact with someone there throughout the war. Actually, he was the son of my mother's PE teacher. And when we visited in 1993, he took us to the old cemetery in Halberstadt, which was very much hidden away. Actually, it was behind the Catholic section, and therefore it was not destroyed by the Nazis. And we were able to locate relatives in graves there that had not been destroyed in the Holocaust.
We had taken Hannah's mother and aunt back to their hometown after the wall came down, because Halberstadt was in the former East Zone, and they did not want to go there while it was under communist rule. But interestingly enough, Hannah's mother and aunt had never been in the, or as they say, and more appropriately, on the cemetery, not in the cemetery, as we say, which we're not quite yet. But in those days, children weren't allowed to go to the cemetery. So they had never seen the gravestones of their grandparents until we made that trip.
Well, you made another trip that is in a place that's currently in the news, near Kiev. Right? Is there the village, the shtetl?
Who's Marty and I?
Marty,
yeah, Marty and
okay.
I went there.
Yes. Okay, you talked about walking through the streets of Frankfurt, where your grandparents had lived. So, could you tell about going to this little shtetl near Kiev?
Yes, Marcia and I took a trip to Ukraine, and in that trip, it was actually a trip down the Dnieper River. But I got the opportunity to actually visit my father's birthplace, which was a small town, about 50 to 80 kilometers from Kiev.
West of.
And it was a very small town. It was a wonderful experience, absolutely, to see where he grew up on that. Yeah.
And we visited a cemetery there.
Yeah, we did.
And there was a large commemorative stone for the people who were killed in World War II in that cemetery as well.
That's right. That's right.
Well, this has been a very interesting and serendipitous program, but it's now time to say goodbye to you.
Okay. And this is KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, and today your hosts have been Susan Franson and myself, Marty Miller, and we want to thank our guests, David and Hannah Gradwall. Marcia Miller, thank you so much for your interesting conversation. The show was engineered by Rebecca Ryder, newly married, and congratulations, and we're glad you're still with us, Rebecca. The music you heard was Diaphamous Charms by that wonderful klezmer band Beyond the Pale, from their live CD called Consensus, that is produced by Boralis Records here. And we have a theme song, and our theme song is Backtracking by our local musicians Al Harris and Tom Richards, from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk, like all KHOI programs, is now streaming live at khoifm.org. You can also listen to our programs from our website at khoifm.org, where there will be links to the individuals and organizations mentioned on our show and a little more information. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show. You can join the team as a reporter by calling 515 292-2878 or, again, at our website, khoifm.org.
Your support as a listener or a contributor is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and
see you again on the radio.